Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I want to thank the Philadelphia Society leadership for the honor of participating in this panel. And I promise as few ad libs as possible. We need to get through this expeditiously. My title is Compromising the Nature of the Union, 1820 to 1860. The framers of the Constitution recognized that in a country as extensive as the United States, compromise was the price of union. Whether the price was right remained to be seen. In the first half of the 19th century, the example of the founders was looked to as a standard of judgment in controversy over the nature of the union. That standard ultimately proved illusory when the geopolitical sections that constituted the country fell into irrepressible conflict. The founders created a states union that was neither a nation state constituted by an aggregate popular sovereign, nor a continental empire. States union was an association of independent polities based on a voluntary mutual pact. It was not a one-sided assertion of will in which members were incorporated and deprived of statist identity. Moreover, in the concept of states union, there was an ambiguity that permitted or encouraged secession as a legitimate course of action. In the view of political scientist David C. Hendrickson, the American Union was, quote, a raging state system disguised by the forms of a constitution which averted periodic wrecks by skillful diplomacy. It was an international system in embryo, and it was no more exempt from the specter of war than any other system of states. Now, point number two. In the history of the administration of Thomas Jefferson, Henry Adams wrote, quote, American constitutional lawyers never wholly succeeded in devising any form of secession which might not coexist with some conceivable form of union, such as was recognized in the Declaration of Independence. Adams claimed, however, that no form of secession ever yet devised could coexist with the Union as it was settled by the Constitution of 1789. For authority, Adams cited Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution, providing that, quote, no state shall, without the consent of Congress, enter into any agreement or compact with another state or with a foreign power or engage in war unless actually invaded. Point number three. Politicians in the first party system explored the constitutionality of interposition and nullification. In the second party system, 1832 to 1850, Southern politicians gravitated toward the doctrine of state veto or nullification, advocated by Vice President of the United States, John C. Calhoun, in controversy over the tariff in 1832. President Andrew Jackson, leader of a new party, the Democracy, defended federal authority and declared nullification and secession treasonable if exercised by force. To check Jackson's ambitions, an anti-executive party was formed, the Whig Party, largely by Henry Clay, a famous compromiser. Compromise on slavery was a practical necessity in the Federal Convention. Subsequently, balance between free and slave states was maintained in order to keep slavery out of national politics. This rule was tested in the Missouri Compromise Act of 1820, which admitted Missouri as a slave state, Maine as a free state, and it prohibited slavery in United States territory north of the 3630 line. In the 1830s, radical abolitionism introduced a disuniting proposition into American politics. Rather than a sectional interest motive, abolitionists professed a redemptive moral philosophic motive that was expressed in the assertion that the Constitution was a covenant with death. Point number four. In the 1840s, the Democratic Party abandoned the practice of compromise over slavery received from the founders. President Polk annexed the Independent Republic of Texas as a slave state, and he declared war on Mexico under the banner of Manifest Destiny. Representing anti-slavery and free soil opinion, Pennsylvania Democrat David Wilmot in 1846 introduced a resolution prohibiting the extension of slavery in territories acquired from Mexico, intended to extend the Missouri Compromise prohibition of slavery in national territories. The Wilmot proviso provoked a political crisis. In 1850, Congress legislated a sectional compromise to preserve the Union. California was admitted as a free state, breaking the balance between slave and free states. A more aggressive fugitive slave law was enacted. The slave trade in the District of Columbia was abolished, and the western border of Texas was settled and its public debt assumed. And most significantly, I think, the Wilmot Proviso was repudiated by legislation authorizing the citizens of Utah and New Mexico territories to decide whether slavery would exist in those two territories. Point number five. Democrat administrations in the 1850s proved incapable of maintaining the peace. Causes of incipient disunion included the ambiguity of states' union as a constitutional design, the decline of sectional comity, territorial expansion, the rise of mass political parties, and a politics of conscience that deplored compromise as an unacceptable compromise of moral principles. The Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854 was the fatal step leading to disunion. Introduced by Democrat Senator Stephen A. Douglas of Illinois, the law declared popular sovereignty to be the rule for deciding whether slavery should exist in territories of the United States. In a fury of condemnation, free soilers, former Whigs, and a significant number of Northern Democrats formed the Republican Party with the objective of placing slavery in the course of ultimate extinction by prohibiting its extension into the territories. Point number six. The Kansas-Nebraska Act released forces of revolutionary violence. In 1856, armed conflict erupted in Kansas between pro- and anti-slavery partisans seeking to organize a territorial government. In 1857, the Supreme Court issued the Dred Scott decision holding that Negroes were not citizens of the United States and that Congress lacked authority to prohibit slavery in the territories. In 1859, abolitionist John Brown, backed by Northern abolitionists, undertook a slave rebellion in Virginia. Brown and his followers were tried, convicted, and hanged by the state of Virginia. In the election of 1860, the nature of the Union and the right of secession were at issue. There were four candidates: Abraham Lincoln, Republican; Stephen A. Douglas, Northern Democrat; John Breckinridge, Southern Democrat; John Bell, Constitutional Unionist. With a plurality in the popular vote and a majority in the Electoral College, Lincoln was constitutionally elected President of the United States. South Carolina seceded from the Union in December 1860, and in April 1861, the Confederate States of America attacked Fort Sumter, and the war came. Claiming to be the true bearer of American republicanism, each side accused the other of constitutional error and infidelity. The nature of the conflict was such that, in a peculiarly American way, the cause of constitutionalism claimed by the sectional rivals was identified with the right of revolution in the Declaration of Independence on which the Republic was founded. Now, in part seven, I offer snippets of competing views of leading statesmen of the time in debate over the right of revolution. Buchanan, President Buchanan, annual message, December 3, 1860. Buchanan: no state at its will and pleasure may secede from the Union in accordance with the Constitution. This does not mean that the people of the South are without redress against the tyranny of the federal government. The right of the governed to resist oppression of their government was embodied in the Declaration of Independence. The South has a right to repeal Northern laws interfering with the rendition of fugitive slaves. If refused, the injured states would be justified in revolutionary resistance to the government of the Union. Another statesman, Jefferson Davis, Senator, U.S. Senate, January 19, 1861. Our fathers did not mean that the right of revolutionary force could only be invoked when that right was wrongfully denied. If Great Britain had admitted the Great American Doctrine, there would have been no blood shed. Quote, are we now to roll back the whole current of human thought and again to return to the mere brute force which prevails among beasts of prey as the only method of settling disputes among men? If so, the blood of the revolution was shed in vain. No great principles were established, for force was the law of nature before the battles of the revolution were fought. Abraham Lincoln, first inaugural address. I hold that in contemplation of universal law in the Constitution, the union of these states is perpetual. No government proper ever had a provision in its organic law for its own termination. Continue to execute all the express provisions of our national constitution, and the union will endure forever. Plainly, the central idea of secession is the essence of anarchy, a majority held in restraint by the constitutional checks and limitations, and always changing easily with deliberate changes of popular opinions and sentiments, is the only true sovereign of a free people. Furthermore, says Lincoln. This country with its institutions belongs to the people who inhabit it. Whenever they shall grow weary of the existing government, they can exercise their constitutional right of amending it, or their revolutionary right to dismember or overthrow it. Abolitionist James Freeman Clark, not well-known abolitionist, but his comment is very pertinent. Thank you. James Freeman Clark writes, secession, concession, or self-possession. He says, revolution is secession accomplished forcibly, and secession is revolution accomplished peaceably. If you grant the right of revolution, you grant it with the right of secession. With it, the right of secession. Suppose we attempt to retain a state that would secede by force. Secession has now become revolution, and what was wrong if done peaceably has become right when done forcibly. He says, I can see no sense in this course of reasoning except perhaps this. It shows that a state is so much in earnest that it is willing to fight for it. It will not act lightly, but will count the cost of fighting for its independence. Thus, by granting the right of revolution, but denying the right of secession, we prevent a dissolution of the Union, except under the gravest circumstances. But if we admit a right of secession to a state, whenever it will, by passing a vote, we make the Union a rope of sand and destroy the stability of government. Do I have one more minute? Okay. Then the final document here is a book review, anonymous book review, Atlantic Monthly, 1881. And it goes on, he says, it's a review of Jefferson's, Jefferson Davis's history of Civil War. Davis refuses to acknowledge that secession was revolution, and the one vital point is whether it was possible, not whether it was legal. The question in 1860 was not, have certain states or the people of certain states the constitutional right to withdraw from a compact? The question was what it had always been. Have those states sufficient reason and sufficient power to revolutionize existing government and substitute something else in its place? I conclude by saying, where does that leave us? And we will be looking to the next two panels to discuss whether the right of revolution is still there, or it's been absorbed, abolished, or what has taken its place in the way of changing governments. Thank you.